I don't know how many of you know who I am. I know some people do. I have some colleagues that are in here that I've spotted already. But I'm not sure how many other people know who I am. So I figured that I would begin by introducing myself briefly. My name is Andrew Suderman. I am Canadian. My family is up there somewhere. My wife Karen is up there taking care of the slides. My children are over there, Samantha and James, behaving themselves. And if not, I can see them, so that's good. My name is Andrew Suderman. I'm Canadian. We moved to Harrisonburg in January 2017 to work and teach at EMU. I was born, just as a brief kind of introduction, I was born in Canada in Rostrum, Saskatchewan. For those of you who don't know where that is, Rostrum, Saskatchewan is kind of like the armpit of Canada. It's in the prairies. When I was two, my parents became missionaries and we lived in Bolivia for a year. In Costa Rica for a year, and then we lived in Bolivia for 4 years, at which point we moved to Kitchener, Ontario for 4 years. We then moved to Bogota, Colombia, where we lived for 5 years. I then went back to Rostrum to finish my high school and lived there for 2 years, then lived in Saskatoon for 2 years, went to Winnipeg, went to Canadian Mennonite Bible College or Canadian Mennonite Bridal College for 5 years. Karen and I met at CMBC. Job was completed. I lived in Winnipeg for 5 years. We then moved to Leamington, Ontario, where we were youth pastors for a year. We then moved to Kitchener for 5 years, where I worked at a homeless shelter. And then we worked with Mennonite Church Canada Witness in South Africa for 7 years. Both of our children were born in South Africa. And then we returned in 2016, spent a couple months in Canada, and then moved here in January 2017. Now we've been here for a year and a half and a bit, and are making our home in Harrisonburg. And so that's who I am in a brief kind of little tidbit. I'll be impressed if anybody can tell you how old I am, or if anybody can tell me how old I am based on those figures. They do add up. I teach at as part of the BRAT department, the Bible, Religion, and Theology department, newly named. I like the acronym, we're brats. So that gives you a little picture of who I am. And it's nice to be here with you this morning. Thank you very much for the invitation. I understand that last Sunday you focused on the theme of the generosity of God and looked at the feeding of the multitude as recounted in John chapter 6. Today, I believe the proposed theme is the perception of scarcity, or facing our fears about scarcity. This, I think, is a very relevant theme as so much of our society and social practices, our politics, our economics, our organizational priorities, are shaped by this basic fear, a fear that there is not enough. Recently, such fear has been used to justify practices as that have not welcomed immigrants to a particular land, whether it is Europe or Colombia or the US. The logic is the same. And it is used to justify the safeguarding of that which we perceive to be ours. The basic assumption seems to be that because of competition, or to put it more nefariously, those who do not have our best interest at heart, we must secure what we need, what's ours, so that we may not only survive, but have what we need to thrive and be free. Thus, we take care of ourselves before we can take care of others. Such a logic assumes that to thrive and to be free is to A, be self-sufficient, and B, not be burdened by the needs of others. This is one of the most common questions raised about the Canadian healthcare system, for example, and our taxes. Doesn't it bother you that you need to contribute towards someone else who may be sick? Doesn't it bother you that your cash would go and support someone who may take advantage of the system? Interestingly, this is the basic logic regarding the tariffs slapped onto Canada recently. And so it's kind of interesting that Phil would invite a Canadian to visit here this morning. You can talk to him about that later. Tariffs were placed on particular Canadian imports, specifically steel, because of a supposed threat to national security. I didn't realize that Canadians were so threatening. And I have no idea how these newly imposed tariffs affect preaching engagements, but I guess that's something that MC USA and MC Canada have to sort out. It is deemed as threatening to rely on another country for a product that is needed here, specifically for its national defense needs. The US, in other words, is not self-sufficient. And this poses a risk or a threat. It's not something that they want, although some economists see this more as a tactic regarding the ongoing NAFTA negotiations or whatnot, but be that as it may. The basic logic is that the individual, capital I, is at the center of what's important and what matters. And I must protect myself, my interest, my community, my nation from others. What I find interesting is that the very meaning of the word individual, its etymological root, means to be indivisible. And yet, it is only indivisible when it is separate and apart from others. And so for an individual, that is someone who, based on the very meaning of the word, is separate and apart from others, to be free means that they inevitably must be free from the other. An antagonism, therefore, exists from the very beginning. Individual freedom means, at its core, being free from others. And individuality means being separate and apart from others. The etymology of these two words, individual and freedom, when conceived together, do not allow for the possibility of community. Differently, it forms the foundation of a self-centered lens and form of politics. That is, a form of the way in which we relate to one another. I've tried to outline the basic logic of this cycle, or what I'm working at this, so it's a kind of a draft. But a fear of scarcity, a basic fear of scarcity, leads to individualism. That is, looking out for oneself. Because there are limited resources or too much competition, I must secure what I need. Individualism then leads to hoarding. Sometimes we call this saving, and I say this recognizing that our financial consultant is sitting amongst us here. But sometimes we call this hoarding or saving. I must accumulate so that I'll have enough for when I need it. Hoarding then leads to protectionism. I need to protect what is mine. Protectionism leads to paranoia and mistrust. I'm scared that others will take what is mine or what I perceive to be mine. And this highlights the fear of scarcity. And so the cycle continues. Living in South Africa for 7 years, we've learned how the South African legacy of apartheid is perhaps one of the best examples in how this fear of scarcity was translated into a politics shaped out of such anxiety. South Africa is a beautiful and marvelous land with amazing people, and we miss it every day. And yet, as many of you, I'm sure, know, South Africa has a long and painful history of colonialism and racial segregation. Its colonial history began with the arrival of European settlers in 1652. And from 1652, segregation and separation became the way of things. The original intent was for the Cape to be a filling station for the Dutch East India Trading Company, for its many ships traveling to Java and India, a route that revolved around the spice trade. Right from the start, the European colonists planted a hedge of bitter almond in order to keep the local bushmen away from and apart from there, the European livestock and gardens. You can still see part of that hedge just outside of what is now Cape Town. Because of the desire to be separate, most interracial interactions were condemned, from trade and business to interpersonal and most definitely romantic. There was, most specifically among the Europeans, a desire to remain pure. In 1857, for example, the Dutch Reformed Church officially decided that the church would be separate along racial lines. There would be a white church and there would be a black church. And later on, there would be a colored church and an Indian church. Although it already largely existed in practice, the official policy of apartheid as law began in 1948. Apartheid literally means apartness or separateness. And the architects of apartheid tried to describe it as, quote unquote, separate development. The idea being that each racial grouping or nation could and should grow and develop on their own. The apartheid government thought it was better for each tribe and racial group to be separate and apart. Although the architects of apartheid deluded themselves in thinking that this was somehow an altruistic and benign system, the fruits of the apartheid policy quickly became apparent. Those who were depicted as quote-unquote non-white were extracted and forcibly removed from their land. In 1913, just over 100 years ago, the Lands Act came into effect, which ensured that over 80% of the land went to whites, who were less than 20% of the population. Here you can see the dark areas of the map of South Africa being the land, and not even the most favorable land, obviously, the land that was given to those who were depicted as non-white. The system made it so that everybody who was depicted as not white had to declare and get permission as to where they could go in their own land. This included where they could live, work, walk, sit, eat, etc. Each person who was depicted as non-white had a passbook that they had to carry with them, which documented the permission they had from their white bosses as to where they could go and what they could do. Space was determined for people. And when people stepped outside of those spaces that they were expected or allowed to be in, the consequences were dire. And so, as one can imagine, this had a dehumanizing effect. Those who dared to imagine something different, and those who dared to step out of what was expected and enforced by law, were met with incredible force. The measures taken to maintain the desired separateness and protect the apartheid-created social order were ruthless. In 1960, for example, there was the Sharpeville Massacre, where a group of people, thousands of people, gathered in order to march to a police station in order to hand themselves in. They marched without their passbook in order to hand themselves in. As they approached the police department, the police opened fire, killing 69 people, most of them shot in the back as they were running away. In 1976, there was the Soweto Uprising, where, due to a change in policy overnight, changing the teaching medium from English to Afrikaans, a language that many people did not know at that time, the children, the people in from 13 years and older, gathered and organized together and marched in opposition and in protest to this change in policy. And so again, thousands upon thousands marched in Soweto to the police stations in order to demand that English was reinstated as the teaching medium. And once again, the police met them with force and opened fire on them. Hector Peterson, who was 13, was one of the first who was killed. Detentions, imprisonment, torture, killings, disappearances, all became common for those who challenged the apartheid system. Steve Biko is probably one face that many people might recognize. He's the father of the Black Consciousness Movement in South Africa. He was assassinated on September 12, 1977. These were the politics that anxiety created. The fear of scarcity that led the European settlers to think only about themselves and their own people, causing them to demarcate what they perceived was theirs, which then led them to protect what they had at all costs, creating a social order that separated and segregated through strict and oppressive mechanisms against those who would challenge their privilege and way of life. Envisioning a different reality, a different form of politics, a different way in which we could relate to one another, was and still is a dangerous affair. Put bluntly, the fear of scarcity led to the politics of anxiety, which ultimately was a politics of death. Now, with this as our background, this morning's biblical text point to a different logic. The portion read from the book of Exodus recounts part of the story of the Hebrew people wandering in the desert after God heard their cries and, through Moses, helped them escape from slavery in Egypt. During this exodus, however, the people became disillusioned, discontent, and even rebellious at the predicament in which they found themselves, a predicament for which they quickly blamed God. The Hebrew people even began to reminisce about their life of slavery at the hands of their Egyptian oppressors, depicting Egypt as a land of plenty. Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat and when we ate bread to the full. First of all, I doubt that was actually the case. In the beginning of Exodus, in the Exodus account, for example, we hear about the cries, not the murmurings, of the enslaved Hebrew people. Second, as the people murmured while they wandered, God, interestingly and amazingly, responds, providing them that which they both needed and wanted: quail or meat in the evening, and manna or bread in the morning. This action demonstrates God's graciousness in providing for God's people, despite their complaining. And yet, there's an additional feature that's particularly interesting in this story, and which I fear we don't pay enough attention to. Not only does God provide, but with God's provision comes a test or a requirement to take only according to one's need. In other words, God introduces a new social logic, one that is not dictated by greed and a concern for oneself, that is, self-preservation, but rather one that is based on trust in God and a concern that all will have what they all need. This becomes the basic principle of God's community. This becomes the basic principle of justice and shalom. And this becomes the essential feature to which the prophets hold the Israelite community accountable. This story of God's provision in Exodus comes back to light in John's Gospel. Last week, I believe you looked at the story of Jesus miraculously providing enough food to feed a crowd of 5,000 from 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. Shortly after that scene, in the same chapter, we hear about people seeking out Jesus because they wanted more of the bread that he provided. They remind Jesus of God's provision in the desert. And so they ask, "What work will you do so that we may believe?" As though it wasn't enough already to feed 5,000 from 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. Oh, how short the memory is. Jesus, however, in a very interesting dialogue between himself and these people, makes a few interesting and noteworthy suggestions. First, Jesus says, "Do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has set his seal on him." We in the global north may too easily spiritualize Jesus' message here. For many of us have our daily bread, and so we don't need to pray for, let alone trust in, God to provide it on a daily basis. As a result, we can too easily interpret this phrase as though Jesus is not referring to the material reality of bread, but rather in some kind of spiritual manna that will give us everlasting life. But perhaps Jesus here is picking up on the basic principle that we noted from the Exodus story. Perhaps Jesus is suggesting that one should not labor on accumulating more than what one needs because it only perishes. Rather, one should focus on the basic principle that everyone should have what she or he needs. This basic principle that serves as the foundation for justice and shalom, which Jesus himself provides. Working toward this basic principle of justice and shalom may be the food that endures. This, Jesus says, is the work of God, that you believe in him whom God sent. I can almost hear the Exodus exhortation, trust in God that all can have enough. Second, Jesus reminds the people, most assuredly, I say to you, Moses did not give you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. Lest we fall into the temptation of spiritualizing this phrase as well, note that the true bread which God provides comes from heaven to give life to the world. And three, Jesus then makes his main point, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. Like the story from Exodus, Jesus may be providing a new logic, a logic that suggests that if we truly believe and trust in God for our very sustenance, we can let go of our need for self-preservation and ensure that others will have what they also need. Indeed, in Matthew and Luke's account of the temptations, this is precisely the logic that we find. When Jesus was tempted by turning stones to bread so that he could feed himself, the temptation Jesus faced was, how will you use your power? Will you use it for your own sake or for the sake of others? To feed yourself or to provide food for others? Jesus' response to the tempter, in citing Deuteronomy 8:3, highlights how God did not provide manna so that God's people could eat and survive on it alone, but rather to trust that God would provide. Jesus would then demonstrate through the feeding of the 5,000 how his interest was not to use his power for his own sake, but to help feed the multitude. It wasn't his belly, it was the belly of 5,000 others. It is when we focus beyond ourselves, taking only what we need and ensuring that others also have enough, that we truly begin to understand what it means to live according to God's logic, to participate in God's work in the world, which John later on alludes to in chapter 17. In fact, it is only in assuming this alternative logic that we truly understand what it means to live. A lot more can be said about these texts. They're very rich. But allow me to conclude by returning back to South Africa. The whole story of South Africa was not bleak, despite the legacy of colonialism and apartheid. People found hope even in the midst of apartheid and its violence and oppression. Interestingly, however, hope emerged precisely when one challenged the apartheid system and its politics of anxiety. In other words, hope emerged when people embraced a logic that focused on the well-being of others, working to ensure that all could belong and have enough, even if we stepped out of the cycle, or even when we stepped out of the cycle of fear. As Dorothy Solow once put it, hope is found in the midst of struggle. And this was true in the South African case. Those who consciously stepped out of the cycle of fear and embraced a vision based on a vision of justice and holistic political, economic, social, and racial togetherness and wellness, or what we might describe as shalom, they found hope in the struggle against apartheid. People knew what they did not want to embrace, and so they sought to create new spaces in the midst of the old that operated according to a different politic, one where everyone mattered, one that provided a glimpse, a taste of the future they desired, one that demonstrated the kind of relationships they wanted to embrace, one that operated on love and radical hospitality, and one that sought to serve and care for the well-being of the other. These became hopeful spaces. And so, I ask, how are we doing? Are we focused on ourselves? Or is our gaze beyond ourselves? What would it look like if, in our personal lives, we only took what we needed and focused and worked on ensuring that others would also have what they need? What would it mean if our organizations would first look to ensure the needs of others before its own? Would we trust that God would provide? I don't have the answers to these questions, but I hope that we may have the courage to trust in God and seek only that which we need so that everyone may have enough. Amen.